This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January the 2nd, 2017. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated. This we're going to take a look at developments that we begin the brand new year. And we'll take a look at this week an issue where we look at an exemption that was denied for an organization trying to become tax exempt because it was decided that the criteria for who it would benefit was too narrow. We have final regulations issued on passive foreign investment company ownership and certain reporting forms. We have the case of an investment advisor who improperly tried to assign income to an S corporation to avoid self-employment tax, and his structure failed. We'll talk about why that failed. The IRS has identified a new listed transaction, this one involving conservation easements. And finally, we'll look at a case where the use of a wrong form was ruled by the National Office of the IRS to not invalidate an extension of the statute, but because only one spouse signed it, it was only valid with regard to that spouse. Well, we're into a brand new year now, so we're welcoming in. You know, the holidays now have finished. We've got our Christmas bulbs going up there, and we're going to be putting away all the Christmas decorations and coming into 2017. And so 2017 becomes now, as always, the beginning of tax season is coming. I'm sure you're all looking forward to that. And a brand new year is underway. So we're going to get a look at getting this year started. And the first case we're going to look at this year, the first issue, is we're going to look at a private letter ruling request. This is PLR 2016-52029. And this was an issue for an organization that was attempting to effectively be granted a 501c3 status to be an exempt organization. And this organization in this case, in the private letter ruling 2016-52029 that was issued on December 23rd, was going to be giving scholarships. And it gave the idea that it would basically seek contributions, and then it would give scholarships. And scholarships would be based on the following criteria. It would grant scholarships to graduating seniors from a specific high school. To qualify for the scholarship, the graduating senior had to be a national merit finalist. And the graduating senior had to also be planning to attend and eventually actually attend a particular college. Now, this scholarship could then be awarded to that senior for all 4 years of the college. So this was the concept here. So we'd have this nice scholarship granting organization. And so far, so good. But there was a little bit of a problem here. Normally, the high school graduates about 500 students per year. And 2 years ago, the IRS noted that there were four individuals who graduated from the high school that were National Merit Scholars. The organization had no idea if any of those attended the college that would have qualified for it. The prior year, there were two individuals that graduated from the high school and National Merit finalists. One of them was the son of the founders of the organization. And the other individual was not related to the founders. The son went on to attend the college in question and was awarded the scholarship. The other individual did not attend that college, was not awarded the scholarship. This year, there was actually one individual who's a National Merit finalist, and it's unknown if he's going to attend the college in question, and if he did, he'd be awarded. Now, the IRS looked at those facts and decided, well, there's a little problem here. It appears to be too narrow. I said there's a couple of problems here. It's been totally funded by the donors, who were, you know, mom and dad. It will only exist as long as the donors fund the award. It's not a perpetual fund. It's paid out of the fund. It's not like they put money in and, you know, we're getting the earnings of that fund and using that to pay the scholarship, nor do we have any source of raising funds otherwise. So essentially, all the money so far has gone to their child. And eventually, you know, probably wouldn't be surprising to find out that at the end of 4 years, they stop making contributions to this fund. So based on those facts, the service decided that it's a too narrow a purpose, that the purpose and the criteria was too narrow to benefit the general public. So they felt that it was primarily set up to benefit the founders and so effectively allow the founders to make a tax deductible payment of their son's tuition is effectively what was happening. So the organization was denied its exempt status. The IRS found that it couldn't qualify for its exempt status. Next up, we have Treasury Decision 9806. It was issued on December the 28th. And this is the issuance by the IRS of final regulations on determining ownership of a passive foreign investment company, reporting requirements for shareholders of such passive foreign investment companies on Form 8621, and some additional information about exceptions for the requirement for shareholders to file Form 5471. Effectively, what this did was went ahead and finalized what had been issued as proposed regulations 3 years ago, along with a couple of revenue procedures issued since then that dealt with how to report this. And there were some minor changes to the regulations from their proposed form to the final form. Some of the things that are covered here is, first, it tells us that a person generally will not be treated as a shareholder of a passive foreign investment company if, in fact, that person has their ownership indirectly through a tax-exempt organization, like, say, a retirement plan. The IRS concluded that was contrary to the rules for PFICs to have to, you know, to look through and find ownership in what would otherwise be a tax-exempt entity. So the IRS decided that that exemption would work. There was also some concern about the rules for attribution via domestic corporation that were contained in the proposed regs, and where some people said, well, that could cause double reporting. We'd end up with multiple people deemed to be owners of the same PFIC. Well, the IRS in the final regulations added an anti-duplication rule that will stop this from happening. So essentially, we'll not end up with two people owning effectively the same shares of the stock. The final regulations also clarified some exceptions to filing that are going to be involved here, where we have the issue of a Form 5471. It makes some revisions to a regulation. If you're, let's say, you have an ownership interest in a foreign corporation for which requires you to file a Form 5471. If there's another person that's required to furnish the information, you can generally do that on a joint return. What the regulations now provide is if you are relying on somebody else's 5471 to cover your reporting obligation, you now are going to have to give information about that other person's reporting, that specific information, to be attached to the return. And similar rules will apply if you are an officer. You can use the same sort of, you know, rely on somebody else's reporting for 5471, but again, you have to attach information to the return. These final regulations generally take effect for returns filed on or after December 31st, 2013. As I said, that's mainly because they are right in line with what had been the temporary regulations and our notices 2014-28 and 2014-51. So effectively, we've just now adopted those as final. They do cover, and so obviously they would cover reporting you're going to be doing this year. Next up, we have the case of Fleischer versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-38. This was issued on December 29th of 2016. Now, this is one of those situations we all run into from time to time. You have a taxpayer who has income coming from some source. Let's say he has a contract with another party. Sometimes we see it as realtors with contracts with real estate brokers. Sometimes we see it, as in this case, with a financial advisor who has contracts with various organizations for which they are selling financial products. Now, they have this, they have a contract with themselves personally, but then they look up and discover they're paying self-employment tax. And they discover that, oh, they've read articles, or their buddy talks to them, or maybe they even talk to another advisor, tax advisor, who talks about the fact that, oh, no, you don't have to pay all that self-employment tax because really you should be an S corporation, and then we could pay you a reasonable salary, and then any other earnings that you have in the organization would not be subject to self-employment tax. Well, that was kind of the structure that we had here. So Mr. Fleischer had contracts to sell investments with both, in this case, his link in Linsco's Private Ledger Financial Services, LPL, and MassMutual. Now, he had contracts with those organizations. Both contracts were with himself personally. Shortly after he entered into the contract with LPL, and before he entered the contract with MassMutual, he formed an S corporation. And that S corporation, then he was hired as an employee of that corporation. The corporation was formed in theory to provide financial planning services. However, the contracts with LPL and MassMutual never named the corporation as the entity which was performing services for those two organizations in which they were paying. Now, Mr. Fleischer had, you know, said, well, that didn't really matter because I'm reporting it over there. I'm assigning, you know, I didn't say the word assign because that's going to be our problem. But he's effectively saying that, oh, no, the income really is the S-Corp's income. Well, as the tax court said, determining who's the owner of income in a corporation, where you have a corporation, an employee that owns 100% of the corporation that's performing all the services, is not always easy. But generally, to have this happen, we need to have basically two things need to be shown to show that the corporation is the owner. First thing is the individual providing the services must be an employee of the corporation, and the corporation can direct and control in a meaningful sense. And secondly, there must exist between the corporation and the entity that is using the services a contract or similar indication recognizing the corporation's controlling position. So those two tests must be met. As you might guess, our problem is going to come on the second test. And by the way, the same problem comes in many cases where you see other situations where somebody tries to incorporate a business where they are being paid primarily by one other party and their contracts with that other party. Now, you know, what this gentleman said was, well, you know, okay, fine. They didn't mention the company. But effectively, they're saying, well, here, the problem is that, you know, it's not really feasible for the S Corporation to become registered to sell the investment products. Now, I initially tried to argue that it couldn't, but the court decided that wasn't really true. And secondly, to be honest, eventually the court would decide that it wouldn't really matter, even if it was true. But then he said, well, it just would have cost way too much money to have gotten the corporation qualified. So he should be able to, you know, because of that fact, we should just be able to ignore it because it's impractical to make the corporation the actual party that's been contracted with. I should be able to ignore that. The court very simply said, no, you can't ignore that. If the corporation is not the party that is actually contracted with to perform the services, then you cannot consider this corporate income. Now, in this case, because it was an S corporation, we're not talking about an income tax difference here, but we are talking about a major difference in the amount of self-employment tax he was going to end up paying, because he was taking salaries that were in the low five-figure range, you know, kind of, let's say, middle low five-figure range, but he was getting six figures of flow-through income. The court found that there was no evidence that either LPL or MassMutual actually even probably knew of the corporation. Certainly, they didn't treat the corporation as who they were contracting with, and they didn't pay things to the corporation. In fact, on the final Schedule C that he did, there were 3 years under exam. He did what, of course, you might see a lot of times happen in this case. He would report the total revenue reported by those two entities on a Schedule C and then back it off on the Schedule C and report it over on the S Corporation. Bottom line, it didn't work. That income had to be reported on his personal return, and that meant that the entire amount was subject to self-employment tax, and he was subject, therefore, to paying a rather significant chunk of self-employment tax on the amounts that he received from these two entities. Now, the sad part about this case is that he formed the S Corporation, the court noted, after consulting with both an attorney and a CPA. Now, court doesn't actually say the attorney and CPA were aware that the company wasn't contracting, you know, that LPL and MassMutual didn't contract with the entity. But unfortunately, I've seen cases I've run into where I've seen, you know, returns prepared by others or advice given by others. And I've noticed that, you know, people like to just ignore the problem. It's impractical, so we're going to ignore it. We're just going to pretend it's not there. This case makes it very clear you can't pretend the problem's not there. You need to get an actual contract with the S Corporation or this cannot work. In this case, because he didn't have a contract with the S Corporation, because the people buying the services were not contracting with the S, in fact, arguably probably would have refused to contract with the S, essentially, sorry, guy, you have to treat it as a proprietorship because that's what the people paying you want to deal with is you personally. That means that there was no way to get around him having to pay the self-employment tax on the amounts he was receiving for his financial planning work. Next up, the IRS in Notice 2017-10 has added a new transaction to the listed transaction category. This particular case deals with certain syndicated conservation easement structures that are being marketed. And what the IRS has identified, again, if they identify something as a listed transaction, when that happens, a taxpayer must file with every return that is affected, that the transaction has an impact on, where, you know, where the transaction has some impact, must file a Form 8886. By the way, this is true even for returns that had already been filed before the transaction was listed as a listed transaction. Technically, under the regs, you have 90 days from the day it's identified to file an information supplement for those prior returns. Now, as we'll discover, we're going to get a little more time under this notice than the 90 days, but that's true. So if you enter one of these transactions, let's say, and it was reported on your 2014 or 2015 return, then the client has to file this 8886. In this point, we'll discover by May 1st of this year. If a taxpayer does not file the 8886, there are two negative consequences. Generally, the statute of limitation on the transaction for the IRS to assess tax will not start, will not end until 1 year after the date on which the taxpayer actually files the 8886 for the year in question, or the taxpayer is essentially reported by the promoter who sold it, who also has to register and report and, you know, file reports in this area. The other side of the equation, which is bad, is there is a penalty. The penalty it shall be 75% of the tax benefit of the transaction. This is regardless of whether that benefit turns out to be allowable or not. And the rules provide generally that for a listed transaction, the penalty can be no more than $100,000, but must be at least $5,000. And this is a per year penalty. So every affected year will round up at least a $5,000 penalty if there's no 8886. And each year could have a $100,000 penalty to the extent that there's at least that much benefit being claimed. So effectively, if you're claiming somewhere over about $133,000 worth of tax reduction, you're going to get a $100,000 penalty. Now, the transactions covered by this that are identified by the IRS are transactions that either fit the category we're going to discuss here or are substantially similar. Now, remember, substantially similar is interpreted very broadly, so you have to be careful there. But the transaction in question has promotional materials offer pastor investors a charitable contribution that is greater than or equal to 2.5 times the amount that they invest. And the pass-through entity is going to contribute a conservation easement. And that's how they're going to claim the deduction. If your client has invested in such an activity, it must be reported on the Form 8886 for all affected years. As well, if you are essentially a material advisor, the material advisor reporting rules also are going to be triggered on this transaction. Now, the IRS, as we said, normally you have to file these reports, so it has to be with any affected return. So if, let's say, a return was being filed today for a fiscal year taxpayer, the 8886 has to be attached to it right now. And for older returns, we've got 90 days to get it filed. Well, the IRS did grant relief in this case. Effectively, for any return that was filed before they identified this as a listed transaction, and for any return that was filed from the day this was put out until May 1st, your 8886 will be considered timely filed as long as it's filed on or before May 1st of 2017. So you have until then to get this straightened out. Okay. The IRS, as we've noted, we've seen a lot of cases on conservation easements, and apparently the service is now concerned that people have been selling this as a marketed shelter. Well, the IRS now wants you to tell them if you bought such a structure. In theory, your structure may be perfectly okay, But that's not the question for this point. The question there is just identifying that you become, that you've entered into such a structure. Finally, let's take a look at a chief counsel email, 2016-52023. This was issued on December the 23rd of 2016. And the question here becomes, there was a bit of a goof by the agent in an examination that was being conducted. As most of us are aware, quite often when an examination is underway, it may take quite a while. And we may start getting close to the expiration of the statute of limitations for the IRS to assess tax. Under Section 6501(e)(4) of the code, the taxpayer and the IRS are allowed to enter into an agreement where the statute will be extended. Now, it could be a general extension. It could be a limited extension based only on the item in question. But you can sign that document. Now, obviously, a taxpayer doesn't have to sign the form. But as most of us quickly become aware, if you don't sign that form, the service is going to effectively assess at the highest possible amount that might be assessable based on what they know as of the date you decided you wouldn't extend the statute. That doesn't mean it always makes sense to extend the statute, but you do understand what's likely to happen if you don't, and so you have to balance that out. Well, in this case, the taxpayers had decided to extend the statute, but the agent prepared and gave to the taxpayers for signatures a Form 872H, which is generally used to extend the statute of limitations for trusts, rather than the regular Form 872. The regular Form 872 has signature lines for both a husband and wife if there's a joint return. Now, the form was signed by the husband, the 872H. That's the only signature line. They had one signature line there. He signed it. Apparently, after the statute would otherwise have expired, somebody noticed the problem with the 872s. So now they went back and asked the national office, do we have a valid statute extension? The national office determined that the statute extension was valid. Now, this makes some sense. We talked about a little while back in 2015, a case of Heartland Management Services versus Commissioner, where the IRS agent had put the wrong dates on the 872, but the taxpayer represented by a CPA was obviously aware of what they meant. I think in this case, the same theory would apply. When the husband signed the 872H, he was aware of what it meant. And so even though there might be the wrong form, his intent was to extend the statute, so we're fine. But the national office did point out one little issue that we have here. Because the wife did not sign the 872, the wife has never consented to extend the statute, and there's no written evidence that the wife would consent to extend the statute. So the national office determined that the statute extension would only be valid for the husband. So if there is an assessment of tax made, the IRS effectively only has rights to pursue that collection or make an assessment against the husband rather than the married couple. So it's an interesting problem, interesting issue, and an interesting result because effectively the IRS does not have the right to move against the wife in this case. Well, we're getting January now. And so there's still some time for many of you to get last-minute state society training. In some cases, there are live courses being conducted by your society in the month of January, so you may want to take a look at those. In other cases, your state society is offering via its partners and via other structures courses that are being webcast into the state. Specifically, many of your state societies are picking up webcast courses from the California Society of CPAs, and you can sign up for those through your state society. But make sure you take a look, again, for those things you might want to brush up on, you might want to take a look at what your state society has in offerings, both if they have live courses, if they have things like the Cal CPA webinars, but also you can look at for their partners that may offer you certain training and specialized problem areas you might run into this tax season. Because we're coming down to it now, tax season starting very shortly, so time to make sure you're really ready for tax season to start. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of January the 2nd, 2017. As always, we post our regular updates on the website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF that has the articles with all of today's topics available in that PDF. So you can read our write-ups, get links to the actual source documents. You can send any questions or comments you might have to me, my email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. On Twitter, you can find me at edzollers. And again, we'll watch for you now as we get into 2017, talk to you about developments in the coming weeks, and get into the brand new year and also into the brand new tax season.